November 6th, 2022. Ward Green here. 10:16 hours. This is, as the title says, Oscar Peterson and Count Basie and Joe Pass, 1980.
My first guest tonight is a gentleman that I have the highest admiration in the world for, because he's doing something that is really unusual in the jazz world, and that is playing solo concerts. But not just that fact alone distinguishes him from a lot of other artists. The fact that he's doing it on solo guitar, which is even more difficult. He's a genius within... Welcome back, Joe. It's great to have you back on the show. You know, we haven't done this since, I think, a couple of years when we did a show with John Williams.
That's right, yeah.
And you were discussing then, at that time, the thing about playing, both of you were discussing playing jazz guitar against classical guitar. What I want to talk to you tonight about is something that you've been doing now for quite a while, as we all know in here, and that is the unaccompanied concerts, which I think is very interesting because it demands a certain approach, doesn't it, on guitar?
Yeah, it demands, a variety of approaches. It demands establishing a rhythmic pattern, right? You know that, and harmonies, and single note improvising. So you have to sort of put this all together and
make it
actually
work.
Make it work, and it's under an illusion that it's all happening at the same time.
That's right. Well, you know, what people don't realize, and I'm sure, you know, I say this meaning that it's a total innocence on their part, is they don't realize what a two-hour concert really means. In essence, you know, you walk out on some of these stages that become extra large, don't they, when you're one alone. They start looking like the Sahara Desert.
I can tell you a story. I recently played a concert and had my watch on the amplifier. I played three tunes and looked at the watch, and only 6 minutes went by. And I thought to myself, God, I have another 65 minutes or so.
The other thing I want to talk to you about was the different requirements as you move through different types of guitar playing. Solo guitar is one. Then, of course, there's the aspect of playing in a group, which we've done many years.
Yeah.
And the thing about, for instance, phrasing within a group, phrasing, being able to phrase with each member of the group as one, which is very difficult. Right?
Yeah, also the fact that certain people phrase very similarly, so if you put those kind of people together, you get a good phrasing, or it may be, in other instances, it takes a lot of rehearsal or tightness in order to have everything sound like, have a unison line sound like one person instead of three or five. Or
that's right. We have a good instance of this, which we're going to show you now, because recently at Festival Hall, there was a concert with the Count Basie Orchestra, and I think we both agree, as most of you probably will, that that orchestra breathes as one. And I think you'll have a good instance of hearing this on their rendition of April in Paris.
That's the band that swings.
Well, you know, that's the band that will, as if you check back in history, it's always sounded basically, that's a bad pun, that way.
Yeah, it had the same sound and
feel. The same sound, and no matter, the amazing thing about that orchestra is whoever seemed to come into the orchestra immediately took on the complexion and the attitudes of the orchestra itself.
That's true, yeah.
Because they have that delayed phrasing, you know, the relaxed feel. It's incredible. The thing that interested me also, I had the opportunity during the time that the band was appearing at Festival Hall of having a head-to-head talk with Bill Basie over two pianos, and I would like to play that for you now so that you can hear the result of the interview. Bill and I have spent many, many evenings in many, many concert halls in many, many places of this world, cities of this world, sitting in dressing rooms, talking, I guess, as any two pianists would about some of the pitfalls of doing what we do for a living with these two musical giants that we call pianos. And one of the points that I wanted to talk to Bill about tonight was his feelings about the piano, his instrument. It's been his instrument all his life. Here we are sitting playing the two giant Busendorfers, Bill. What were some of the pianos like that you had to play during the early Kansas City days? You mean they weren't Busendorfers?
Well, I tell you, there were some brutal uprights.
What's a brutal upright?
And some of them were real nice, too, you know?
Oh, yeah, some of the uprights are great.
Believe me.
You could get a good sound.
And some of them had pedals on them that had little things on them that around it. They had some different little string sounds to them, you know, that added a little jazz to them. And there were some nice ones, really, actually. And when they built this monster here, they built it right there. They made it for you. Nobody but you, especially that other thing they got down there on that trip me on one day.
Well, yeah, I was going to mention that. We Bill and I played a concert somewhere in Germany. And, of course, the earlier models of this particular piano were like the one I'm using at the moment. Bill doesn't have it on his. Mine is an earlier model because it has a flap on it that opens because there are extra keys. And and at that time, they used to leave the keys, the extra keys, in their normal white and black configuration. Now, of course, on Bill's piano, the one like the one he's using today, they picked those
sold black. Pardon? All soul keys you had over there.
All soul keys. Anyway, one night, I preceded him on a concert, and I went out and was fairgrounding a little bit, and I was playing double octave things. And these keys, actually, by themselves, they don't really sound that good. I'm telling you now. But in tandem with octaves, then it gives it a lot more body.
You just had to play that, you know.
So I went out and I was playing this with the trio, and inadvertently forgot and left the flap open. And then Bill came on with the band, and he elected to play one of the stride things. And I was standing back there, and I heard misses, which he never does. I've never known him to miss that, and it was sounding like you. And I went out, and I looked at Bill, and he had made the mistake of looking down at the keyboard. I had left the flap open, and of course, with the extra notes, it threw his perspective.
And I was looking for him after.
But you know, actually, what do you look for? What do you like in the way of a piano, Bill? What type of piano do you like? What do you like in the way of a feel?
Well, I don't know. Just a good feel. I mean, this is a beautiful piano that I'm sitting in front of. Really.
Does it affect you? How does it affect your playing? If you, for instance, you're a very speculative player. You are thoughtful. You're very sparse. We all know this because this is the one thing you brought to the jazz world. And if you ran into a piano that is very light, let's say, what does it have any particular reaction on you?
Well, I don't know, Oscar. I don't know how to answer that question, really, but it does have a wonderful feeling for me because I do like a light piano.
You like a light piano. This is what I meant. You prefer the light action compared to the
most definitely
to the heavyweight action.
Believe me.
I would like to do, to illustrate Bill's touch, I'd like to do a tune that I have to admit this, that I didn't realize was his composition until about 2 years ago when we did a performance together. Why don't we do a couple of choruses of Blue and Sentimental?
Yeah, that would be nice. Help my ass cap, anyway.
Thank you.
wish that tune was as pretty as that introduction you made on it, really. Oh, boy.
I was trying to think of what the tune was. That's one of my longer introductions.
Yeah, well, you see, that's one of them strikes again. There you go.
I wanted to ask you a question basically has been burning in my mind for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And I have heard a lot of conjecture about this from various people. You know, the discussion has come up over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I would like to hear it from you directly.
Right.
Probably the two most famous orchestras of all time. If I have to be have to be chauvinistic about it, I would have to say they would be your orchestra and Duke's orchestra. All right. What would you say was the difference? What would your impressions of the difference
class
between the two bands be?
Class. The master. He had
really?
It. That was the man. That was the man.
The band.
He was the boss.
You did play together at one point.
Yes, we did.
Really?
I was in the hall.
You.
It's beautiful. The greatest.
Well, I know how he loves
it. It was a pleasure and honor to be in the same hall with the Duke. What more can I say? Don't ask me anymore about it.
All right. Yeah, well, the other thing I want to ask you about is another great that we used to talk about. And we were talking about musical intimidation. And I was talking about how my idol, and I'm sure the gentleman that you revere, Art Tatum, used to literally intimidate pianists. And it's one thing for people to understand what the word means insofar as lifestyle, but insofar as a musical style, I can remember, as you, I'm sure you vividly remember, what pianists used to feel like when he used to walk in the room that they were playing in. What did you get out of Tatum? When did you first meet Art Tatum, first of all?
Oh, I met Art many, many years ago, and we were traveling through Toledo, and I was with Benny Moten, you know? And I made the mistake, we stopped over in Toledo for a stopover, you know, I made the mistake of said there was a piano there in this little room, you know? And I don't know, I don't know what made me sit down at this piano and play. And in those days, I thought I could stride a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. And somebody walked over to me and said, oh, this is our table being here, man. And I really hadn't heard of it, you know, too much, you know? So something told me to get up from that piano. I listened to that, something told me. And I got up. And Art walked in there. He must have been there. I don't know what brought him in there. But somebody must have told him there's a kid in there trying to play some piano or something like that. So he walked in there and just played a half a chorus or something. And that was all. That's how I met Art, really.
Really?
And, but then I heard him several times later on at a lot of different meetings when everything was quiet when he walked in and sat down. That's the way it's always been.
How about the piano parties? You mentioned once about...
Except when you came, and he really admired you an awful lot. And I remember the time when you went looking for him.
No, I just...
Knocked on his door.
I was always suicidal.
No, it wasn't like that. He respected you an awful lot.
No, I loved that. We were very close friends. But, you know, you told us some time ago about a very funny scene where he walked up behind you when you were having... In the middle.
Oh, yeah, we were at this little club in Los Angeles. And everybody was there that night. Buddy Rich was sitting in for Joe Jones, who had just been inducted in the Army. And Tommy Dorsey was there, and he was playing. Artie Shaw, I believe. A couple of other guys were playing, and the band was just swinging. And somebody touched me on the shoulder, and then looked back at the Army, and he said, "Hey, I said, what key you playing in?" I said, B flat, and you ain't playing too. He said, what's wrong? I said, you're not playing this piano now. I'm the next set. He goes, when he sits down, everything is destroyed.
Yeah.
Nothing else happens.
It's true.
That.
Well, this is what I meant about the intimidation, because when Artanian used to play, my feeling about it was that whether it was certainly a pianist that thought they wanted to follow him, they would change their mind. And if it was a horn of some sort, there was always a scuffle as to who was going to play the next solo following the piano solo. They'd be all pushing each other, saying, well, you got it. And he said, no, you've got it. You know? Because he played so much, and he had a trick he used to do. If a soloist was playing, they're playing something above this tempo, he would lay one of these on him, like... And of course, right?
That's just what you've been doing to me all the time.
But that was one. But I don't think. I think that Art actually did that because he was like kind of a prankster. You know, he loved doing that. He was very much in love with this instrument. We all know that.
Yeah, I don't think he could stand in any spaces.
No,
he couldn't stand no space.
Now, even on the ball of the boxes.
That's right. Yeah.
But the thing that I admired about him was I remember the intimidation that I suffered when I first met him. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm, as a matter of fact, very honored to say it, because he meant a lot to me and still does. And I used to come apart whenever he'd come in, you know, just be destroyed. I'd be playing something and go into my, that bag, anything. And he took me aside one night and he said, you know, if you have to hate me, if that's what's going to make you get over this, you just have to hate me. You know, you can't just hate somebody, you know. Just voluntarily.
I can.
Yeah. You can? I don't believe that.
But pretty, but beautiful.
But I thought you cared all these years. And really, he, it wasn't a case of really hating him. I had to ignore him as best I could. If you can ever ignore death. I had to ignore
him.
One night he had a way of talking to pianists through the instrument. And one night he came into where I was playing, and I had gotten this nemesis of not being able to play. And we went to an after hour joint afterwards. And he...
Bad news.
He rolled over with, he said, boy, you sure played good. Sound good. You were getting it together, right? And usually in the after hour places, you know, the great instigations that used to go on, they'd see two piano players, they'd see Art, they'd say, well, why don't you play something? And Art, you play something. You know, he went straight to the piano, and he, like, just took it apart, literally. You know, just wasted everything on the piano.
You'd play something like what?
Pardon?
What, will you play something like about eight bars of what?
Oh, I know. I can't really do it because I'm
just
not...
Just a little bit, but eight bars.
I can't do it, really.
You do it.
I have never imitated
it. You just play eight bars. Just play eight bars. Just play some eight bars.
He went through about 10 minutes of something and just wasted it all. And he came back over and he sat down beside me and he said, you know, when I get through, you can have it. You know, he wasn't an ego. He was a very proud man. He should have been. And I think that, I don't think there is a pianist today, if they really want to be honest, of that era that wasn't influenced by him. Do you agree?
I'm with you.
I think so. I think Absolutely. That Artanian was, along with Charlie Parker, who had the same kind of influence on saxophone players, or Lester Young, or certainly Coleman Hawkins. Why don't we do something that relates more to a big band, since obviously this is
talking about Artanian, and we got to start playing this.
Now we're going to start. Yeah, we're going to do
it. It's all right with you.
Let's do one of the big band tunes, Jumping in the Woodside.
Oh, God.
You got it.
I knew it. It's right in here, too.
Frankie, we'd like to thank the great Count Basie for visiting with us and also Joe Pass. And to conclude the evening, Joe is going to help us make a quartet out of the group and join us to do Just Friends. Thank you.
Stay tuned to BBC 4. More Oscar Peters.
Well, I was making my breakfast. I missed the part where Count Basie says, that's another strike on
Bill and I have spent many, many evenings sitting in the wood about some of the pitfalls. One of the was life. Here we are sitting playing the two giant in the earth.
Oh, yeah.
Octave.
I heard that. Here, but
you know, I wish that tune was as pretty as that introduction you made on it, really.
Yeah.
Oh boy,
I was trying to think of what the tune was. That's one of my longer introductions.
Yeah, well, you see, yeah, you see, that's one of them strikes again.
You know. I wanted to ask you a question, basis.
That I loved. That is my favorite part of that whole. Thing. When Oscar said to Count Basie, who's also called Bill Basie, I was trying to think of what the tune was. And the idea being, you know, in case you didn't get it, that he's supposed to know what the tune is because it was one of Count Basie's songs. And to say that he was trying to think of what the tune was a slap in the face to Bill Basie, who then said, "See, that's another one of them. However he put it, that's another one of them strikes." Let's see what he said here exactly.
That's one of my longer introductions.
Yeah, well, you see, yeah, you see, that's one of them strikes again.
That's one of them strikes again, yeah. Yeah. And earlier they were talking about how Oscar had forgot to close or left the little door open on the piano, on the Bösendorfer. At the bottom of the register, the bass. The extreme low notes on the Bösendorfer. I'm going to say Bösendorfer because Bösendorfer is a little too, you know, advanced in pronunciation. Bösendorfer is easier to think of and say, I think, for a North American for an American, I was going to say, but I'm Canadian, of course. But Bösendorfer. And when Oscar left the little door open on the lower notes, then Count Basie lost his perspective, you know, on where he was playing his left hand so that he played the wrong notes. Because he came out after Oscar and played the same piano, and that's why... That's why that happened, you know. But that was during some other performance that they talked about that happened some time ago. At this point, it was some time ago. At the point when, in 1980, when they're making this, evidently, no, this is maybe not, this might not be 1980. It's hard to say whether this is all 1980 or whether the part with Oscar and Joe Pass at the beginning and at the end was 1980. That part was 1980, I believe, but this part might have been somewhat, well, obviously it was earlier, somewhat earlier, but how much earlier? We don't know. And the part where the Count Basie Orchestra was playing, we don't know what year that was either. It might not have been 1980, but could have been. So that's it. That was all. I did a lot of things yesterday. I did a lot. I winterized my lawnmower yesterday, which meant I ran it. It took about 15 minutes or so at the most, or at, almost at the most, 16 minutes at the most maybe, 13 minutes at the least, to run all the gas out of it by running the motor till it ran dry, and then I put some of the synthetic fuel. I think it's called True Fuel. I forget what it's called, but that could be what it is. True Fuel. I put some of that in there and ran that for 1 minute, and then I shut it off and took the battery out, which meant removing a couple of bolts. And I discovered I had a couple of loose bolts on the battery terminals. Both of them were loose, and that's probably why the last time I cut the lawn, it didn't start the first time. And I didn't think to check the battery terminals. I thought I probably thought I made them tight early in the spring when I installed the battery. So anyway, they were loose, and that explains why the motor didn't start last time I cut the lawn. And then the second try it did start, but a battery connection is very important for the starting of a motor. A motor that uses electric start like that, you know. Usually we're talking about combustion engines that do that, but anyway, I did that. I winterized that, but that was just sort of one of the things I did. I also did raking and put some leaves on the garden. I dug up some of the trees that are like weeds, but they're trees growing in the garden that shouldn't be in there. I had to dig up some of those, and I got some of the compost soil out of the compost container from the bottom of it, which I put on the holes in the garden that I dig when I need soil to put around the house. I refilled all of those holes, and then that made the compost lower, so I can now jam in some more leaves and things probably before the winter. And we had that wind yesterday, but it didn't blow all my leaves everywhere. The ones I put on the garden are still mostly there, it seems. So I think everything is good. Everything was, and there was quite a strong wind last night. I mean, even this morning, I could still hear it. And I'm trying to think of, I've got a new idea. Well, I've got this big, I've had this big wheeled cart, you know, a big cart. For years, I've never used it because I didn't have the trailer hitch for it. But it's been sitting out there behind my lawnmower all these years. And I'm thinking about, it's getting rusty though, and I need to do a rust treatment on that to preserve that a little bit. But also, the way to preserve it better would be to put some kind of a wall between the house and the stairs. And the only reason I think I didn't fence that in or wall it in the past is because the stairs are going to pivot when the frost heaves, because, you know, the house is on a foundation, it will not heave, but the stairs could just sit on the ground, they can heave up and down a little bit, somewhat, who knows how much. When the ground freezes, they're going to go up and down, so they have to be well attached. That's one thing to the at the top of the stairs. The stairs have to be well anchored, which I think they are. I added some more security there recently with, I forget whether it was nails or screws. But anyway, I'm thinking I need to figure out how to build a wall there. I've got a lot of wood in the basement that's from a tree, from the big tree I cut down. Maybe I can use that wood to build a wall there, because it's not a lot of wood that I need, but I have to cut that wood. Like, I mean, what's it called? I'd have to rip it. I'd have to rip it into thinner boards. But I think I don't. I'd only be able to rip it once. You know, probably not twice. Maybe some of them I can rip twice, but on the bandsaw I'd have to do that, and it wouldn't be. Yeah, it wouldn't be easy. It wouldn't be easy at all. But I can cut them to length first too, if I want, and then try to rip them. But I'm not going to do any of that if I can't get an idea of how to do it. There has to be a good idea of how to do it. I could attach to the post. There's a post that actually touches the ground. All of these things are not anchored to the stairs. So the stairs have to be able to move. So I can't anchor to the stairs, but I can anchor to the post and to the house. So I should be able to, as long as it doesn't touch the ground, then the ground could still go up and down, and it won't try to lift the house. So there's something has to be done properly there. And that's not something that you would normally do at all without, you know, it's construction. You have to have a building permit. So the only way that I can do it, I can put a curtain, like a canvas tarp or something. But anyway, I'm just thinking of all the different ways. But the wind could blow that. A heavy wind can blow that curtain wide open. I'm just thinking, there must be a way I can do this in a very safe way, you know, with just to keep the snow from blowing in. We don't get a lot of it. It doesn't happen very often that the snow blows in anyway, so I probably don't even... I may not do that. I'm just thinking about it. I need to think about it. I thought about me as a tennis player, and I thought, why did I say I was a year younger than 14 when I was the runner-up? And I'm not sure that really... is true. I'm thinking it's more likely, far more likely that I was 14 rather than 13 when I was runner-up, but something told me in my memory, but that was 1970 or 71, so take your pick. It's still 50, it's still more than 50 years ago, so that, maybe that's why I'm not remembering it very accurately, but it was 14 or 13, I guess. I was that old when I was a runner-up in the Ottawa tournament, so I could play tennis fairly well. That was my point. I knew how to play tennis. That was an Ottawa tournament, and I was from a small town. So what I liked about that, what I liked about everything, what I always like about things is the the things that you accomplish. What the things that I accomplish are the things I enjoy the most, the things that I accomplish on my own, not the things that I have people helping me with. That means nothing to me, because if you have help, and I've gotten lots of help over the years, and it's just the things on which, or you know, to do with which I got help are not the things I enjoyed the most. Now, one exception was Bruce Hawkins, yeah. Bruce Hawkins, yeah, I think. Was the name of the man, young, he was a young guy at that time, who helped me with my Kawasaki 350, because he was a Kawasaki factory technician or so. He was really qualified. And I don't know how he did that, seeing as he lived in a small town, but I guess he didn't live in a small town at the time that he was the factory guy for Kawasaki. That was the thing. It was 3 years before that this bike had been manufactured at the time I bought it. But I needed his help because the bike had been crashed by somebody, and he had to check the frame to make sure it was straight. And he knew he could do that by driving it. He had to ride it. And he got permission from the owner to ride it. But the owner had fixed the bike. You know, it's just it was in a crash prior to me buying it. But anyway, the bike was in phenomenal condition at the time I bought it. It was unbelievable. And it was partly thanks to this to Bruce Hawkins that I was able to ascertain that before I bought it. I paid $650 for that bike, and he was asking a lot for it. The guy I bought it from was asking a lot of money for it because it was, you know, wasn't a brand new bike. It had been in a crash, and he wanted a lot of money, $650. That was all the money I, probably all I had, just about. I had to scrape together the money to get that, to pay that. But I really enjoyed that bike, and I just, yeah, I don't wish I still had it. I shouldn't say that, because I don't think driving on the highway or on the road, it's mainly the highway, you don't want to drive on the highway on a motorbike. But even if you drop the bike on the road, it's hard to pick it up. You know, it's very, very heavy. It was 350 pounds, 350 cc's and 350 pounds to lift it up. And basically you're lifting, you know, you're deadlifting almost. I mean, it's got to be 200 pounds. That you have to deadlift, and I did pick it up a couple of times. I don't know how I did it, because it weighed almost double what I weighed. I mean, it weighed more than double that, but I'm picking it up. It probably was about double what I weighed is what I had to lift. I mean, it was a lot of weight. I don't think anybody wants to drop any bike, but it didn't have roll bars. You know, this bike didn't have roll bars like some of the bikes have and had later, like on later bikes after I don't recall seeing them in the 70s, that these roll bars on the bikes. So I don't think they had them back then very much, but if at all. But the roll bars they have on bikes, if it's a really heavy bike, like a much heavier bike, these roll bars can help reduce the amount of weight you're actually lifting when you have to pick them up, because they don't tip over quite as far. But anyway, yeah. But that's, I don't know how people, you know, can pick up these bikes. Some of them, I just don't understand, or why they would want to, you know, have a bike like that that weighs so much. And that's why it's the same reason why I don't really want to have or wouldn't want to have a bike. But also it's a lot, not necessarily more dangerous, but you've only got two wheels on the ground. Would, you know, if one of those wheels goes flat, one of those tires, you know, goes flat on you or something, if anything happens to one of your wheels, you're in trouble on a two-wheeled vehicle more than in a car. A three or four wheeled vehicle is safer. I guess that's why. And also I like being sheltered from the wind on the highway. The wind is just really extreme on a motorbike, but without a fairing. I didn't have a fairing, of course. It was enjoyable back in those days, especially around town. That was the thing. But that was when I was about 18 years old, in probably 75. I think I bought it just before I went away to university, and then when I came back from university in 76, would it be? Yeah, 76, I guess. The first summer I came back, the carburetor was all gummed up. All the carburetors, three carburetors it had, one for each cylinder, all the carburetors were all gummed up. Three carburetors I had to disassemble, and I needed help from Bruce Hawkins again on that to figure out how to do that. That was bad. I think that happened another year because I still hadn't learned how to deal with it, but the carburetors were gummed up. And then at some point I changed the piston rings and took the cylinders, the head, you know, took the head off, and then took the cylinders right off too. But why was I talking about that? Because this is not why I was talking about it, but in the summer of 76, that's when I started working for Atomic Energy. And I think that was the first summer. I think that was J.R. Johnson. I worked for him in that summer, and then the next summer as well. Maybe all three summers. He got me to come back. I think that was all three summers, 76 through 78. Why do I say all three? What happened? Oh, in 79, I worked for the physical plant at Queen's University in that summer before I went out west to Edmonton. So that's sort of my employment history up to that point. With the 3 or 5 years of tennis instructing, you know, I don't know. I do think I had 5 years of actual tennis instructing. I do think that's going to, you know, have to percolate a little bit more before I can be sure. But that interview with Count Basie was very interesting, I thought. And to hear Oscar talking to Joe Pass and to see what the kind of person that Oscar is, to hear him talking, and it's almost as important as hearing him play is to hear how his mind works, and it's really, I believe it's very instructive. I don't know what we're going to do today. What time is it? We're already done. Our time, it's gone. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the instruction from Ronald Curzan was slow down, right? That was good instruction. I know it's possible. It's always possible to get going too fast, to get wound up too much, and to try to do too many things at once, you know, it's not a good thing. It doesn't work. You know, you can't put on your clothes while you're making your breakfast at the same time as you're planning your day and designing a new thing. You know, you can't, you have to do one thing and then the other, and then you focus on each thing. But I've tried to do things at the same time. It seems like at different times, you need to try it to see if it works or not, but it doesn't work, I've found. So you can't do things at the same time. Or you can, maybe. I don't know. Depends on... But it's not good to rush. That's the basic idea. Basic, again, no pun intended with Count Basie there, but could be a pun, right? Yeah, I thought, you know, there's this idea of false humility. That's what I think. I think there's false humility when people try to, or when they don't give the credit to the Creator, Jehovah, too. And then they don't know what to do because they don't want to look like they're taking credit if something goes well. So they resort to false humility in some way, and they invoke some wrong concept, false gods, you know, which are nothing. I mean, false gods are nothing. There's only one God who's the true God, Jehovah. There's only one God that has any meaning. The other gods have no meaning. They're nothing. And they don't they don't contribute anything beneficial. You know, they can't. They don't. So everything happens for a reason. So if something goes well, the credit goes to Jehovah or nowhere else, or, you know, or nothing. Like, it's to Jehovah or nowhere, or no one, to no one, because to Jehovah is where it belongs. But boast in Jehovah. That's the principle. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with saying that. And there's another way to look at it. That Jehovah sees you as righteous if he allows things to go well for you. So you could say it's living right. If something goes well, you could say, well, I must be living right. That's the way to look at it. That's the correct way to look at it. There's a reason for everything. If something goes well, you must have done something correctly. You must have. But you don't get the credit, but you could still say, you know, it's living right. It wouldn't be untrue. You got to be living right for things to go well. But the credit does go to Jehovah every time. The utterance of transgression to the wicked one is in the midst of his heart. To the director. This is David. To the director of Jehovah's servant David. The utterance of transgression to the wicked one is in the midst of his heart. There is no dread of God in front of his eyes. Look at that. It's talking about the same thing as what I was talking about. I didn't even realize it. I wasn't consciously doing that. For he has acted too smoothly to himself in his own eyes to find out his error so as to hate it. The words of his mouth are hurtfulness and deception. He has ceased to have insight for doing good. Hurtfulness is what he keeps scheming upon his bed. He stations himself on a way that is not good. What is bad, he does not reject. Yeah, I was saying, yeah, the things that I've done on my own, that I've tried to learn on my own, the things that I've done through my own efforts have always made me feel much better than the things that I did with the help from others. It's always more satisfying to learn something new and to accomplish something through your own learning and efforts. And I mean, I'm not saying there's no problems, or there's no failure, or there aren't failures. Along the way, there are a great many more failures when you don't have help, I would say. So it's not that I'm saying that. See, it's not really, we're not talking about doing things your own way because then everything goes better. At least you're in control of it. That's true. That part of it's true. You're in control of what happens. So, and in a way, it does go better because you're in control of it and you don't have problems that could have been avoided that you would have avoided. If you'd been doing everything yourself, you can avoid those problems, but there still are going to be difficulties or problems, and quite severe ones. By the way, vitamin K2, I cannot stress how important that vitamin is. I just can't stress it enough. I can't help people to know this enough. I mean, I don't know. Of course, we don't know how it's going to affect different people. I don't know that. I believe it's like the fountain of youth, possibly. That's what I believe. So, but I mean, yesterday I did those things I described, is what I did. Did I do more than that? I'm trying to think. Well, I had to put the battery on charge for the winter. It's going to be stored indoors. For the lawnmower, I think I basically covered everything I did. Oh no, I brought some old firewood. There were some old logs that I had down in the ditch at the back that were just getting very dry, and so they're ready to burn, but they're also getting, you know, I'm not going to store them in the house. If I'm going to burn them, I have to bring them in the house and then burn them immediately as soon as they come in. Whatever I bring in has to be burned immediately. But, you know, they've got fungus growing on them and stuff like that. You know, they're not rotten. They're not rotten, but they're very, very dry. It's cherry, actually. I've got a cherry tree. It's cherry wood that I cut. I cut from a cherry tree. When I cut the cherry tree down, it's already, most of it is already barked. I think there was one big log there. Where did I put the big log? I need to cut that. Yeah, I'll need to cut that at some point. So, but that's wood that I can burn right away. So I'll have wood in an emergency if I need it. From that wood as well. That's another source. The wood at the back there, I can't bring it all up, maybe. But I made a wood pile back there where I just threw that wood back there and didn't use it. You know, I didn't do anything with it at the time. That was some quite a few years ago. I think it was when Anne was not as healthy anymore, probably. It was probably in her later years anyway. It was, so I was not doing as much planning about all the things I was doing somehow. For some reason, I decided to put some of my wood at the back of my property in the ditch and just leave it there, which later on I realized that's not the best thing. You just don't want to have anything runoff, you know. The rain washing rot into the creek, you know, so you don't want to leave that stuff there. So every day, right? Yeah, we work at stuff. Then, speaking to Jehovah, David says, "Your righteousness is like mountains of God." Your judicial decision is a vast watery deep. Man and beast you save, O Jehovah. How precious your loving kindness is, O God. And in the shadow of your wings, the sons of men themselves take refuge. They drink their fill of the fatness of your house and of the torrent of your pleasures you cause them to drink. Of the torrent of your pleasures you cause them to drink. Makes me think of my matcha tea. For with you is the source of life. By light from you we can see light. Continue your loving kindness to those knowing you and your righteousness to those upright in heart. Oh, may not the foot of haughtiness come against me. As for the hand of wicked people, let it not make me a wanderer. There the practicers of hurtfulness have fallen. They have been pushed down and have been unable to get up. That was Psalm 36. We're very near the end of our study here. I wonder, how long is Isaiah 16? Maybe it's very, very short. Perhaps we can do it. Perhaps we can do it. I don't know. I doubt it. But oh, it's 13. We probably have time. Send a ram, you men, to the ruler of the land. So, little children, let's do this. From Selah toward the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion, and it must occur that like a fleeing winged creature chased away from its nest, the daughters of Moab will become at the fords of Arnon. Bring in counsel, you men. Execute the decision. Make your shadow just like the night in the midst of noontime. Conceal the dispersed ones. Do not betray anyone fleeing. May my dispersed ones reside as aliens even in you, O Moab. Become a place of concealment to them because of the despoiler. For the oppressor has reached his end. The despoiling has terminated. Those trampling down others have been finished off the earth. And in loving kindness, a throne will certainly be firmly established. And one must sit down upon it in trueness in the tent of David, judging and seeking justice and being prompt in righteousness. We have heard of the pride of Moab, that he is very proud. His haughtiness and his pride and his fury, his empty talk, will not be so. Therefore, Moab will howl for Moab. Even all of it will howl for the raisin cakes of Kir Hareseth. The stricken ones indeed will moan because the terraces themselves of Heshbon have withered. The vine of Sibma, the owners of the nations themselves, have smitten down its bright red branches. As far as Jazer, they had reached. They had wandered about in the wilderness. Its own shoots had been left to luxuriate for themselves. They had gone over to the sea. That is why I shall weep with the weeping of Jazer over the vine of Sibma. With my tears I shall drench you, O Heshbon and Eleale, because shouting even over your summer and over your harvest has fallen down, and rejoicing and joyfulness have been taken away from the orchard, and in the vineyards there is no joyful crying out. There is no shouting done. No wine in the presses does the treader tread out. Shouting I have caused to cease. That is why my very inwards are boisterous, just like a harp. Even over Moab and amidst of me, over Kir Hariseth. And it occurred that it was seen that Moab was made weary upon the high place, and he came to his sanctuary to pray, and he could not accomplish anything. This is the word that Jehovah spoke concerning Moab formerly, and now Jehovah has spoken, saying, within 3 years, according to the years of a hired laborer, the glory of Moab must also be disgraced with much commotion of every sort. And those who remain over will be a trifling few, not mighty. That's the end of Isaiah 16. And I thought of something. It smells beautiful in here because of my foot powder. I smell it everywhere. I don't know why. It's not on my hands. It's just everywhere. I had it on my hands this morning, but it's not. The smell that I smell in here is just fantastic because of the rose geranium oil and the tea tree, I guess. But the rose geranium is the most amazing smell. But all of it, all the combined elements of that powder just smell phenomenal, just wonderful. So like the foot powder, who would have thought that it's like smells like heaven? You've got having your feet smelling like heaven is just a great thing. So I've got my toothpaste, I've got my foot powder. The recipes are, I'll at some point, maybe I'll write them down online, put them online, post them, but they're in the videos where I've talked about them. If you can find them, the foot powder was recent, but the toothpaste was earlier. If you can find those videos, they're not even difficult recipes, especially the toothpaste. It's not very difficult, but I'll probably talk about it another day when we have more time too. But they're phenomenally helping me. I mean, they're phenomenal recipes for non-edibles. I mean, well, the toothpaste is fully edible and the foot powder might be, but I wouldn't eat foot powder. You wouldn't want to try. And toothpaste you would not need to eat. It's very edible, but you don't want to eat that either. But they're very safe because they're practically edible, let's say. And the toothpaste works really well, from what I can tell, phenomenally well, but it certainly, I'm doing it in conjunction with my chewing of xylitol gum, though. Those two things together. But I was chewing the xylitol gum before, and it didn't prevent cavities. So the toothpaste is what seems to be doing all the benefit. But plus, maybe the fact that my nutrition, more vitamin K2, that might have something to do with it, too. And all my other vitamins, none of which helped before, though. But I'm taking more K2 now, too. But I wasn't taking more K2 at the time when the cavities seemed to stop. I stopped getting cavities before I started this increase in K2, so it's the toothpaste. I attribute it to the toothpaste, plain and simple. It works. Let's just baking soda, xylitol, roughly 1-to-1, and then a little bit less of 1-to-1, or a little bit less than 1, of the coconut oil. And then the only other thing is your essential oil, peppermint in my case, but you put in some kind of flavor. The xylitol does the sweetening, the baking soda does the scrubbing. The coconut oil makes it a paste, and it's very healthy for everything in your mouth. Very, very healthy. Very great stuff. And xylitol is excellent for oral health, and you've got the baking soda. That's not bad either, but it's a scrubbing agent. It's a gritty factor that you need. And there you've got it. That's toothpaste. So I just did the toothpaste right now. But the other, and the peppermint or whatever other essential oil you might want, you could use spearmint even, or you know, whatever other essential oil you want for flavoring in your toothpaste. But the foot powder, I have 3 or 4? 4 versions of it. I made 4 versions of foot powder, but it's basically, I'll figure out a way to describe it in as few words as possible in the next video, hopefully. This is Word, or you know, soon, I mean. So this is Word Green. It's November 6th, 2022. 11:36 hours. I love you very much. Bye for now. Have a great day. Thanks for listening and welcome.